The gist of all this is that there is nothing formless in nature, and even if there were, a man couldn't possibly know it. Also, I quote from White's section of this book, every particular form has its own special significance within the universal order of which man is part. This is specifically used by a great deal of poets these days, particularly in America, of the kind associated with projective verse, the kind associated in this country with Bob Cobbing, who takes great risks of superimposing sounds on tapes in the knowledge that the formal action continues all the time. So the interrelationship then of external and internal environments in a moving field can be put on a tape-recorded poem in many ways. One poet does it by tape-recording the sounds and his voice and other people's voices as he goes across America in his station wagon, and then uses that as a basis for organizing everything that is to the point. Like Wittgenstein said, everything is the case. Now, scientists then work with the idea, not of visual shape, but the occupation of space. And philosophers, after Wittgenstein and Minkowski, also do it. And this is, you know, the basis of McLuhan's theories. It's rather astonishing for me to discover, by the way, I didn't really know the stories of Jorge Luis Borges. I know you do. But do you remember there's a story? I couldn't name it. Do you remember this story? There's a story where he described the universe in terms of interrelated cones. It's a weird thing. Now, I discovered the other day that a lot of astronomy, in fact, uses conic sections for describing how the heavens operate and how the velocity of light operates through those conic sections. And then one reads the story of Borges, and the imaginative process is exactly the same. I don't know at all whether in fact he picked the one up or what happened. Okay, the sixth thing here then is that these all the transformations and changes in these systems are in fact focused on two kinds of growing points, two generative points. They are these. I'm taking this from Conrad Lorenz's books on form. First of all, there is the what is called gestalt, which he defines as visual perception of single completed configurations. Visual perception of single completed configurations, where the whole appears to dominate the parts. That is, it's your eyes that are doing it. Okay, that's fine. Provided you say the visual perception of the thing and it appears. Secondly, the mosaic idea, I quote, perception of sharply defined parts in the whole. Now, the gestalt idea then and the mosaic idea are in fact terms through which we can talk quite sensibly to the biological information about what we do when we make forms. And the last and seventh thing is to do with this word, aesthetic. Now, the word aesthetic now has to mean not only shape and structure, but the formative process itself of perception, plus the personal needs of the perceiver, plus the perceiver's social and historical context. Because of the fact there is this multiple action of the single field. The idea that somehow, as Coleridge knew in the dictionary, that somehow you can just, in fact, look at the thing and not feel it, that is, as a human being in a historical culture, is ludicrous. So, this is what is recognized in the poems of Duncan and Olson, and to a certain extent in Pound. That is, that aesthetic has to mean a situation in an environment of overlapping, interpenetrating situations. Let's then now think about how this can be applied in a particular form, which isn't poetry at all, but again, I have a composer I'm particularly interested in. It's a bit of a hang-up, and again, I apologize for those who heard this one before. That is the music of Yanis Xenakis. Now, Xenakis is a contemporary French-Greek composer, he's Greek, who lives in Paris, who worked with Le Corbusier, and and is in fact an architect as well as a mathematician as well as a composer. Now he uses in his musical structures 20th century extensions of Lord Kelvin's formulation of the movement of particles in the system. What is an archivist is concerned with, which fascinates people concerned with form at all, is this. He's interested in the ways in which sound phenomena follow universal laws, that is, we know about their wave structures. But in fact, there is also a structure not of complete determinacy, but a structure of indeterminacy, of chance, which is statistics, and of randomness, which is non-statistical chance. Now, what he's trying to do in his music is to use a combination of the laws of sound, the mathematical laws of chance, and to combine them such that there are areas of randomness. Now, that follows exactly Lord Kelvin's theories of particle structures. You see, what he's trying to do here is to use chance as a scientific concept in such a way as he's making forms which are not rigid. Now, central to this is the way he uses the theory of large numbers. Now, this goes like this, in case you don't know. It's to do with repetition. Now, clearly, every artist is concerned with repetition. How much do you repeat inside a form such that it isn't rigid? That is, it doesn't begin to die on you. Now, this theory of large numbers can be exemplified by tossing a coin. That is, you know that the number of times you toss a coin in a chance trial sequence has this structure, that the probability of the results tend to a determinate end which approaches certainty the more times you toss the coin. Probability of the results will tend to a determinate end approach certainty the more times you toss the coin. So there's a scale. Here. He uses the word stochastic here to mean probability tending towards a certain goal. He also uses the kinetic theory of gases, that is, the laws controlling particles in cloud densities of sound. Bob does, by the way. This poet was operating here tonight. I was talking to him about this other night. He's very concerned with the movements. The density of sound and voices you can get at a single point on the tape. What I'm saying then with all this is quite a simple thing, subsuming it all. It's not a question there anymore of the application of science to art. But it's to do with, like the authors of White's book, Aspects of Form, the fact that all activity is subject to some laws and processes and some structures of indeterminacy, whether you call it chance, statistics, or randomness. The principles of scientific order, then, and the principles of art are not parallel activities. I'm reminded here very much of something else we want to look at, I think. Again, familiar to some of you. This is Jerome Rothenberg's book called Technicians of the Sacred. Now, this is a book of translations of primitive and archaic poetry taken from every conceivable ethnic area. And he says in an article about this kind of poetry, it isn't in the book, I'm taking it from another source, if any one thing characterizes modern poetry, obviously no one thing does, it is its rejection of the idea that poetry can be defined with reference to a limited number of forms or shape of poems. For anyone who still thinks that the position he's defending, the simplest argument might be, we do what we do because we know as much as we know. What we know is that poetry is a universal activity involving so many norms or modes that to think one or other as more natural or evolved or complex no longer makes any sense. Poetry everywhere is as complex and developed as language and as varied, the implications of which any comparative linguist will understand. If you look at Chomsky's theories of language, you'll see that in fact he's concerned with this one too. that is, that there is a single generative function of language. There's a little book about this one. I must say, I'm not particularly convinced by that entirely myself. But certainly, I'm giving you the directions here in which so many fields are operating. Now, what Jerry Rothenberg is concerned with here is this. He's trying to show that poetry universally has structures. Some people might want to call avant-garde and dismiss when they see, in fact, that they are belonging to oceanic islanders or tribes in the middle of Africa or Chinese forms or so on. He puts all these together with modern poetic forms. His idea then is that information and information retrieval as poetry is a universal field of concern, and that it is in fact based on the human ability to make these forms in any cultures, all time, as something that just takes place. It isn't a particular kind of event of any kind. It is part of the biological structure. In fact, what Gary Snyder, an American poet, calls an ecological survival technique, which is what poetry is, in fact. Now, if you look at another group of stuff, Robert Duncan's passages, these are in a book called The Bending of the Bow, you'll see that one way of handling it for a sophisticated Westerner is this. What you do is to make a record, a continuous record, of all your experience, acknowledging the fact that for the poet, like anybody else, one of the biggest problems in the 20th century is to relate the increasingly accelerating amount of information which impinges on you. Now, if you're concerned to make your poetry, in fact, representative in this epic sense, which Duncan is, and most of the major poets in America are, his idea is to make this record shaped in a time and a place, in a form, which is continuously invented. I quote the introduction to Bending the Bow here. And this takes characteristically magical forms. You know how he is, Duncan, as you know him. He says, where other nations before us have floundered, we flounder, to defend a form that our very defense corrupts. We cannot rid ourselves of the form to which we now belong. If the soul is the life shape of the body, great stars that are born and have their histories, we read in the skies and will die, our souls. And this poetry, the ever-forming of bodies in language which breathes and moves, is a field of ensouling, each line intensely a soul thing, a contribution, a locality of the living. And if you're thinking, as I'm thinking, that this is very much like certain passages in Keats's letters, I'm with you on this, because remember Keats talking about the veil of soul making in his letters, and that is as he uses that as a structure of poetry. Moving to another contemporary American poet, Charles Austin, he puts this in an equally complicated way. You can find this in a broadside he wrote in 1968 called Clear Shining Water. His syntax is, again, his own structuring, but I think his ideas are as universal as Duncan's. He talks like this. I've got to read this very carefully because his sentence structure is oral. The topological matter of all matters which can find a basis for physics of the psyche at this revolutionary point in retaking the cosmology of creation as a fact, both in instant and in consequence, hidden or not, in whatever is up anywhere, for whomsoever, the more so now. What he's getting at here is increasingly we are concerned with cosmologies in the past as ways in which people, many of very often non-literate people, have organized everything, which is exactly what the scientific process is now. That is, forms have been found to organize everything. They have been spatial and non-linear, and that's where you look, and Olson's been looking. It's not surprising then that much of Olson's work since I think a poem like West, if you look at it on the page, resembles spatial diagrams of different kinds of energies in various significances. You'll get a large page and it will begin to look like areas of relatable signs, exactly as you get in certain poems of concrete poetry, and poems like by poets like Gomringer and other people of that kind. There is this idea then in Olson that one of the ways you might notate your perceptions such that they relate in a spatial way would be in fact a constellatory pattern, which of course is exactly the form by which our bodies perceive, non-linearly but with the senses together, unless you have one or two of them cut off, of course. Now, one of the most influential books in all this communication theory stuff, as I expect you know, is Norbert Wiener's The Human Use of Human Beings, 1950 edition here. And all this material he places in a framework of laws controlling human energy and the communication of energy and the relation of that to other energy. And the basic law, of course, is the second law of thermodynamics, which organizes what we know about the loss of heat energy in a system, and therefore the tendency to create chaos. I'm taking it for granted that's pretty well known, so I don't want to go into that too much. What I am concerned with is, then, the relationship of these particular ideas, all emerging from Darcy Thompson's materials in this exhibition, and his descendants. There's an enormous amount of this stuff, developed mainly since the 1950s, endless descriptions of the morphological form of energy. Taking that and placing it now, for the second half I want to say, in connection with computers and what they do, and what they can do, and what they can show us. Now, I think the problem here can be summarized in a letter which I read in the Times Literary Supplement the other day. You're probably aware there's been a frightful hoo-ha going on between Dr. Leavis and Noel Allen and all sorts of very dull, boring people talking about the structure of education and so on. I don't think Leavis was boring once, but I was a big man, in fact. But I thought this was awful. And particularly I was appalled by Leavis's shock and scare at the idea of computer poetry. And there was a letter appeared in the issue of 7th of May, from Dorothy Emmett, who is a philosopher in Cambridge who operates in this field of use of computers and philosophy. She says this: whether Dr. Leavis or indeed any of us likes it or not, more and more people are going to be working with computers in laboratories, in schools, in offices. If they get excited by thinking about possible patterns, and here is our bridge word, that is, in which words can be cast, and by playing with strings of words, this might not only enlarge their vocabularies and love of words, but produce a new kind of folk art, she says. The computer would be a tool for an operation which needed both love of words and a scientific skill, and encouraged both. In other words, if you're frightened about technology in that particular crude way we found in both the Nolan and the Leavis materials, it'll get you nowhere except being frightened of technology. Now, this second show that I say about cybernetics is concerned then with the programming of machines such that they can make patterns and sequences and designs and selections. And I'm quoting from a large amount of work here, so like if you don't mind, I won't just say who these people who are involved in it, I've been reading. Quote, the computer is devoid of the prime forces behind creativity, imagination, intuition, and emotion. The computer is devoid of the prime forces behind creativity, imagination, intuition, and emotion. So I want to ask them, well, what is left for them in our concern for the arts? It's to do with the mathematics of design. That is our link to the Gestalt form theories that I've been setting up just now. That is, what you do, what you can do if you want, is to set up a program which will run through a specific pattern in all its variants. Now, this can be used as an analogy with pursuing a theme through all its possibilities in a human being, guided by intuition and all the ways in which we choose. But of course, in the computer, it is in fact programmed already by the human structure. I think the analogy with jazz changes that I used just now might help if I suggest that whereas in poetry the jazz changes would be a good analogy, the figure in computers would be campanology. I mean, the ways in which bell ringing changes are in fact non-random. They're computable, in fact. You can also parody a computer poem to understand what computers are up to. I don't know whether some of you know Edwin Morgan's Computer Second Christmas Card. It's a very good poem to look at, because it's a way of getting into what happens, what usually happens with programmed writing. That is, it gets out of control within its own control structure and transmission system. That is, it's like any other bad writing. It's what T.S. Eliot once called Swinburne's poetry, the morbidity of language. Now, the easiest forms to computerize are mathematically the strictest. In meter, in syllable count, and so on, you can imagine. The haiku, for instance, is ideal for computers, for obvious reasons. And I don't know whether you saw these haikus programmed by members of the Cambridge Language Research Institute, of which Mrs. Emmett is a member, I think. Again and again, the results were extremely interesting, and some of them, seem to be, and please note the way I'm saying this, as good as some of the translations of haikus that I've seen. Now, what one means then is, first of all, an act of recognition. You're saying they seem similar to what I already know, which means that you're choosing out of a wide range of things you want to call haikus. It's very important. It means that not only is the thing programmed, but you, as it were, a human being, receiving these things is programmed to recognize them as haikus. Which means the idea of computer poetry calls for just as much discrimination as Dr. Leavis or any other critic would require when you're reading any other kind of poem. And it's ludicrous to pretend this isn't true. If you had a computer who could choose for you what you should like, that would be something else. So it's not a question of what a machine likes, it's a question of what it can do. Some of the computer passages, though, are absolutely captivating. I don't know whether you saw in this exhibition one use an Italian writer had. He uses three passages from three different writers, which he computed on a tape, and strange combinations of language by machine processes, strange chains of phrases, not selected by a human system. One felt that they have the kind of ability that maybe you could get under psychedelic drug action. But again, one felt that the extremity of it was the equivalent of the way you would operate if you reprogrammed your nervous system through, say, psilocybin or something of that kind. I think there's an analogy very much in my mind to do with then programming of computers and programming of your nervous system, which the poets have always been up to, ever since they chewed ivy leaves and whatever they did. Swigged wine, this is not it, water them up. So, the problem then here is a problem raised and discussed, if you want to get the reference in philosophy, by Jean-Paul Sartre in a book called Psychology of Imagination. I mentioned that just in passing, because he does it obviously very much better than I do, that's a fact. These ways in which then we're concerned with the processing of the productive or the creative act. If you look, we had a poet here at the Poetry Society last year, I think, Ted Berrigan, when was he here? Last year, that's right. And one of his works is called The Sonnets. If you look at Ted Berrigan's book, The Sonnets, you'll find it's a series of poems in which most of the lines are cut into or computed into most of the other poems. But this isn't done by a computer, but the computer could exactly do it. And I was talking to Ted Berrigan about this. And he was very concerned with this idea then of the fact that you could achieve a degree of automaticness in your poetry, which would in fact be a way of springing off imaginative effects in your reader. That is, making relationships and referring to them can be two kinds of programming in this particular way. And of course, immediately, I'm sure some of you thought of this one as I was saying it, if you look at the work of William Burroughs, you'll know very well that when he uses cut-up methods and folding techniques and various other permutation and combination structures, he's doing just this. He's using analogies to the computer here. That is, he's taking existing forms, using an automatic process like hacking at them with scissors and rapid rearrangement, in order to reduce the degree of human intervention. But of course, again, like computer poetry or computer form, he chooses what he will exhibit. He chooses. He's like those guys who came on with monkeys, remember? And they came on and said, look at these beautiful characters. They like scribble away like Jackson Pollock and so on. In actual fact, of course, they waited for the precise moment where the paintings would look vaguely like one of those whirling paintings, and then took it away from the quarry and said, like, well, it looks like art, which is like human creation. The moment you take the thing away from the operation of art is the moment you begin to complete it. The funny thing is, reading William Burroughs' writings, particularly reading The Soft Machine, for example, is that you learn after a while to recognize the processes he's using as a way in which he's reprogramming your response to these elements, and so that in fact you do become, and I'm sure the title is meaningful here, a soft machine yourself. Burroughs is very concerned with what it means when in fact you reprogram the nervous system and its products, and increasing ways in which the societies we live in do just that. And he makes computer analogies the whole time. In this exhibition, and you can still get the catalogue of the ICA show, the cybernetic serendipity, there are many, many examples of this kind of material. I think I'll just leave it to you to go and have a look, if you can get the catalogue, if you didn't happen to see the thing. I want to suggest something else, finally, to you about this. And it goes something like this. You remember, there's always been an urge in poets, it seems. Well, there's all urge, because the ethnic range in Rothenberg's Technician of the Sacred, the range of poets from other societies and other cultures, is so enormous that one feels that one can say something as rash as it seems always, of making structures out of signs of whatever kind, and exhibiting them, or performing them, or saying, look at this in some particular way. We have a poet in this country, Dom Sylvester Ueda, who in fact has reduced many of his poems to signs of very small strokes, or using the non-alphabetic keys of the typewriter. And some of his poems, his pieces, or his poem drawings, looking back computerized, they are in fact the mathematics of his chosen signs. And since he is a Dominican monk, perhaps one feels his work is related to the nature of incarnation, and I mean that quite seriously. Because I think the transposition of energy into forms is what we're concerned with here. I mean, exactly the same way as Mondrian's paintings are in fact nature philosophy, and the way Webern's music is nature philosophy explicitly in their writing. There's a very curious thing. I was thinking the other day of how weird when you think that Dom Sylvester Ueda and Webern's music and Mondrian's paintings are all based on ideas of the natural incarnation of energy in the universe. It seems that this kind of ways then of making signs operate as constructs of universal energy is one of the basic constants inside poetry, I take it. In the 20s, there was an American poet called Harry Crosby who made a poem which consisted of the word black, the word black, densely repeated, surrounding in the middle the single word sun, which is one example of the kind of thing I mean, or one everybody knows, I suppose, is Morgenstern's Fish's Night Song, which consists of a structure of little loops like that, and straight lines. You can find it in his Gallows Song, or Galligan Leader. That's 1905. So there are cases of poems then, and not just in the Western society, but all over, to gather from collections of ethnic poetry, all over our societies, cases of poems that look machine-made, but are not. There seem to be fascinations with signs which don't necessarily have emotional reference. I want to quote here an article by a man called Jean Baudot, B-A-U-D-O-T, called La Machine à Écrire, a writing machine, 1964. He's interested here in a machine which he invented, which is an automatic sentence generator. I quote, and you see how this relates back to Professor Thing, I was quoting earlier, at Cardiff. The final output consists of grammatically correct sentences where word occurrences are purely accidental. There's no way of predicting what kind of sentence will be generated or what words will be associated. That is, it looks like a sentence, it sounds like a sentence, it is a sentence. In fact, it's a sentence. But Baudot adds this. In trying to discover a meaning in these artificial sentences, one feels that many seem completely nonsensical, and this is normally so. In several instances, however, accidental word associations, and who is associating, notice, is the point, produce a stylistic effect which can have aesthetic value, that is, for the person who's looking, not for the machine. It would be impossible to perform such a task ourselves, because a man is essentially opposed to randomness, and incapable of behaving or performing in a random fashion. Now this is a very curious thing. Again, I had words with Bob Cobbing about this. Human beings are incapable of producing randomness or chaos. They can produce confusion, which is something else. But machines can produce randomness at last. But the odd thing is, if you, in fact, get the results, Bob and I got this guy down at the University of Surrey in Guildford. To do this, and we have produced these random structures for us. And such is the operation of yourself as a body, the way, in fact, you can't help but make patterns. This is what Sartre talks about, the phenomenology of imagination. That again and again, the random structure looks like a chance structure and begins to have form. And it's you that's doing it. And slowly, the thing begins to take on formal structure and becomes aesthetically pleasing. And this scientist was saying, like, that's not it at all. Like, Bob and I were going off, like, you know, in an aesthetic way, and started enjoying ourselves. And he got very irate, this scientist, because that wasn't what we were supposed to be doing. And we have this very strange confluence of the two kinds of attitude here, which struck me very much. So this idea then of randomness itself, when you're presented with its result, is a very curious method. This all relates, of course, as you know very well, to the importance in 20th century poetry of collage and assemblage and of montage. That is, the way of putting things together spatially such that A plus B equals anything from C onwards at any point. The collage technique of the juxtaposition of anything to anything and then exhibited as form is one of the most influential kinds of art that we know. I don't think this principle of assemblage has really been looked at or talked carefully to my mind, at least I've not found it. What I'm concerned with then is this, that the principle of cut-up and reassemblage and collage resembles very much some of the computer methods that we've been looking at. I want to quote William Burroughs on this kind of thing. Some of this is familiar to him, I'm sure, where he talks about the methods. Any narrative passage, say, of poetic images is subject to any number of variations, all of which may be interesting and valid in their own right. a page of Rambo cut up and rearranged will give you quite new images, yeah. Rambo images, real Rambo images, but new ones. Cut-ups establish new connections between images, and one's range of vision consequently expands. And he says, free association would not achieve such results, and never back to courage again with the differences between association and imagination. Free association could not achieve any such results because, as psychoanalysts know, one is not free. One's mind can't cover it in that way. And he suggests all sorts of techniques where you can do this. The mind simply could not manage it, he said. It's like trying to keep so many chess moves in mind. You just couldn't do it. The mental mechanism of repression and selection are also operating against you. So finally, let me just point to one way in which this might lead to two ways in which these might be useful, two basic propositions. Seems as it not, I put this to you. The function of poetry then is not to order the object, but to open us up to kinds of experience which can be generated from any particular collection in any order of signs, marks, movements. This is very tricky because these days, as you know, particularly in the States, and certainly said over here, mixed media structures are on the cards. That is, you offer, as the artist who is controlling the event, a whole range of things taking place in space-time, which formally will be separated into language, music, visuals. You offer the whole lot as a single event. They call it various ways, like the theatre of mixed means, mixed media, happenings, events, and so on, in which the various operations take place together. It's these ideas of synchronicity, of simultaneity, of collage, extended right across the board, which one's concerned with. It's the ways in which a poet can, by just pointing to a sign, relieve it of its environment. It's the ways in which John Jonah, for instance, makes a poem by just exhibiting a newspaper headline. Or Aram Saroyan, by exhibiting a single letter on a page or a word, indicates. Which is very like those found object, the objet trouvé kinds of art, where the artist exhibits, say, an old root he found on the beach in a certain way. Or, of course, in the cases of Marcel Duchamp, objects like a urinal or a bicycle wheel, which came before that. Or a scrubber. Isn't it a scrubber, that one that's called In Advance of the Broken Arm? I can't remember. I think that's what it is. But it's just pointing seems to be the form of minimal art. And that is involved here very much. In America particularly, they take things to a very logical extreme in the arts always and push theory through. And minimal art in music and in poetry and in painting and sculpture has reached the most extraordinary proportions now. In music, it can consist of a single tone played over a period of days, such that it becomes an environmental atmosphere which you're breathing, sort of thing. It's like that, too. Or single-tone canvases, which are so big you can't see them. I mean by that the nearer you get to see what they look like, the more your eye can't take in the sides, and the further away you get, the more you can't see what, in fact, the thing in front of you is. Events taking place such that a poem made up of people saying things quite without programming in San Francisco, Peru, and Paris, so that the space-time structure of any work of art is expanded to its logical area. That is, you can have any amount of space and any amount of time. It's as if somehow there's been an explosion. Once it is suggested that everything is related, everything is form, everything is energy, it makes the job of the artist a very curious one now. Very curious indeed. It seems to me that in many ways he is a sort of an entrepreneur of cosmic energy in a way that he hasn't been in the past. And the second proposition is this, that the nature of chaos and rigidity, entropy in a poem, is only conceivable if you acknowledge that chaos is impossible for a human being to create. Coming back to this business, all he does is form. It seems then one must say something like, what is possible is inattention to it, impatience with it, rigid prejudice against it. If it is in fact intensely private, for instance, it seems to be, or it is so big that your sensibility finds it very difficult to impinge on it, or something of that kind. This, it seems to me that one needs here a whole range of descriptive terminology, if you want to describe these kind of things, which is very near itself, in itself, a work of art. Increasingly, to find a way of doing the descriptive work that criticism used to do of poetry, and particularly of sound text poetry, and of the arts in general, you have to make a creative act of finding another kind of work of art which you place beside the other one so that it's exposed as to what it is. This is in fact going on continually, and John Cage is the prime example of this, who again and again says that the criticism of his work, of his own music, if you want to criticize it, would in fact be another piece of music, and leave it at that. I find that very heartening. It would do me out of a job, completely, in fact. I would have to then start doing what I've always wanted to do with students, and it's just like show things and make connections, which is what we've been doing, in actual fact, in the Institute during the last year. These propositions, then, I've offered you over this hour as ways in which I found myself thinking about the arts, promoted, as I say, by these two exhibitions at the ISA, one way back in 51, which I didn't see, but I got the books of and the illustrations of, and this one I did see in the 68, which was to do with cybernetics, the other one to do with morphology. I think this is the kind of material then that we could discuss as creators, as people who are engaged very much in making forms still, and not just pointing to them. Okay?
Thank you very much, Eric. Well, you've covered a vast amount
right.
of ground.
That's
much of it. Fairly unfamiliar to me, I must confess. I didn't know what I'll be for. And a good deal of it needing far more time to digest before one would want to comment on it than
right.
we've got. I think one could launch into all sorts of piecemeal minor criticisms, which might perhaps not be the way to start on it. It would be interesting, really, if we could commence more with this general issue about form and computers,
yeah.
and how far these do present a quite new kind of way of approaching a situation. And this seems to me to be a question arising all the time out of what you say.
Yeah.
How far, if it is as you say it is, let's assume it is for the moment because it isn't quite, but assuming it is as you say it is, how far is this new?
Mm-hmm.
E.g., is this quite different from the situation that we had in the Renaissance, for example? Is it unprecedented in world history? If it's not, clearly we may be moving right through this into a new period of synthesis, a new kind of closed form, or we may be into a situation in which there never will again be any closed.
Yeah, that would interest me very much, what the new closed form would be.
Yeah.
Because that seems to me absolutely crucial. And then again and again, this is very difficult to find out information about. Because half the time people come up with closed form, but they say in actual fact they're as old hat and as boring as anything, because in fact it's filched again.
Yeah.
So I'd like to know what that would be, in fact, a new closed form, yeah.
Can I just have about three uninterrupted minutes, because it's not only...
Well, is that good minutes, yes?
Yeah, yeah, it's not only...
No, it's not three.
No, it's not only what is the content of what is said, it's also the question of the whole basis of the argument, because I think some people would argue that what they're talking about is not art, but technique. And that what is being talked about is the novelty of technique is being used as a substitute for content, a point which hasn't really arisen. Now, to get on to
yes, so I wasn't talking about it.
The nature, yes, but it comes down to the whole of the minimal art is the substance of the art with which you're being presented.
Yeah.
Now, what a lot of people would argue about is that this is not an opening up of new experiences, but minimal art is a limitation of experiences, and indeed, ultimately, an abolition of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, what I'd say about the whole basis of the argument, which is extremely fertile and gets one's mind really moving in 101 different ways, is that there's been taken a lot of scientific conceptual analogies. These analogies, in actual fact, have been taken as facts and not as analogies. That the whole of art on one side and science on the other have been taken to be one and the same thing. Now, a lot of people here who, one or two of the subjects I did know something about, and one could, as George say, go in and say, look, to take Lawrence as being a key man in Gestalt is absurd.
Lawrence. Oh, yes.
You know, I mean, there are far more important people to deal with. Mm. But that's
I no, did take the key man, by the way.
But I don't want to go into that. What I want to go into is the question of the fact that scientific analogies have been taken as scientific facts which can be substituted for artistic concepts. Now, what is the ultimate result of this? The ultimate result of this seems to me to be, a set of uninteresting commonplaces. We make patterns, we have open-ended options available to us. Now, this is something which is not particularly new, which is not particularly interesting. What is possibly interesting is the fact that cybernetics, computers, help us to devise new patterns, but these are really new forms of technique. Now, what one would say, or what is getting at, is that you get out of poetry, which, you know, we could talk about painting or anything else, but we are talking about poetry, that you get out of poetry more than forms, more than patterns, and more than relationships. And that this is to reduce art to a kind of reductio ad absurdum. In other words, it reduces it to its actual technique. And I think that really is the particular point that I'd like to make. And sort of statements like everything is related, everything is energy, everything is form, is, if in fact anybody studies linguistic philosophy or anything else, is in fact a meaningless statement.
My own first reaction is something like George's, that what I think is the main point is a very depressing one for somebody like me, and I imagine for a great many other people.
Come back into this point.
And that is, with a very levelling suggestion, that in fact minimal art is of equal value with maximum craft, maximum content, and that in fact anything that a computer produces has the same value, has the same aesthetic, moral, scientific value as anything that a child could produce, a boilermaker could produce, or a poet, or a musician.
Actually, George, I don't know that Eric used the term minimal art specifically all the way through, did he? Because minimal art, to me, tends to mean a certain kind of painting on the whole, which one wouldn't want to be talking about entirely, because to call Charles Elson minimal art would be rather
right. And who can I ask some of these? I think that what you're saying is completely ridiculous, because I didn't suggest any evaluation whatever. And what's more, I didn't say that minimal art was like to be evaluated with every other kind of art. It was a program, and it's the same art. I mean, George Whiteman attacked me on similar grounds long ago, and I find it very tedious. At Oxford, on the same grounds, and it was practically word for word as unsubstantiated as it was then. He just criticised. He doesn't offer anything in its place.
Well, put the same program as George.
Right. The problem. Can I just say one thing? The idea that one is reducing art, as you say, to technique and techniques is in fact ridiculous, because I was talking about forms and structures, and I made that quite clear. I was not talking about content at all. Now, if I was to give another lecture, I could talk about the relationship between form and content. Or whatever that is. I didn't I care to do that, by the way. Because I think it's a ludicrous idea to separate them. But certainly the idea that someone is in fact reducing everything to some kind of machine.
Yes,
don't
you
weird.
Duncan. Could you give a talk on one and not the other? And is it ludicrous or desperate?
No, I'm just saying, I was talking about forms. Forms, like morphological forms, right? I wouldn't want to talk about, like, there's a thing called content in poetry, you see, because it seems to me that you would have to talk about a whole range of things like George's Renaissance and all endless stuff to do with the cultural environment controlled by human beings, which is something completely different.
Could we just pinpoint this for a moment?
With that.
There's one particular example that you used here, Eric, about Coleridge.
Yeah.
And you said in the dejection note there was biological and various sorts of mathematical evidence for what Coleridge was doing.
Yeah.
Then you related that to the content and not to the form. Now, it would have seemed that your argument should have said that there was biological and mathematical evidence for Coleridge's right to use the iambic form and the rhyme scheme in that way. But that wasn't the point you were making. I didn't quite understand why you were talking about the content.
Yeah, I just meant that point, you know, where he's using he's got his Kantian theory of imagination going about the way, in fact, human beings create what they see, rather than the associationist theory of the previous century.
Again, such a possibility. Again, talking about Borges, you were talking about...
Oh, wait a minute.
...the content, weren't you?
All right, if you don't want to hear that all up, then. I mean, like...
No, it's unclear, Eric. This is my point.
Oh, good, right.
About, why...
You're clear about the Coleridge now?
No, I'm not, because...
Well,
why
of course
you are. Why weren't you talking about meter and rhyme?
Because I was talking about other kinds of structure.
I see. Well,
do you want to talk about meter and rhyme now?
No, I'm anxious, Eric, to get it clear. When you talk about structure, what you necessarily mean by structure, because for a lot of people, to assume that you are not talking about meter and rhyme and poetry when you talk about structure, is to make a rather odd assumption.
Yes,
I was talking about form making.
Yes.
You're talking about transmitted visual perception, not about the transmission itself, but about the perception.
Yes, I still haven't got this one at all clear.
I think you're not getting. People aren't really getting off the ground because they're not tackling the basic assumption you make. And I think, could you correct me afterwards if this is wrong? It's an assumption about entropy.
Yes,
basically. Now, your interpretation of entropy is.
I don't have an interpretation of entropy, by the way, at all.
Well,
I quoted Wiener.
No, I can understand that your side.
I quoted Wiener back.
Okay, yes, well, right. That man's interpretation.
By the way, in fact, I quoted practically everything I said.
Yes.
So that you can't accuse me of having any opinions whatever.
So lead to a certain definition of what entropy is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's with this particular definition to which degree.
You disagree with Norbert Wiener's definition, in fact.
Yeah, because I'm quoting my own sources, and this is once again, this isn't original.
Yeah.
Joseph Needham wrote an essay way back in 1942 talking about entropy.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about two divergent forms of energy.
Yeah.
Entropy is the working down of a system. In
Having
terms of
working
one
down.
Sort of, well, entropy, you know, the gradual working down towards absolute simplicity, which is, you know...
The levelling up of the temperatures, you mean, inside the structure. Yeah.
This is a working down of one sort of energy. But in doing so, this is releasing another form of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And this, in fact, was, although Needham was unaware of it, this was, in fact, being written at the same time by a man called Teilhard de Chardin, the two ideas of radial and tangential energy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, your interpretation of energy is that everything, that there's only one sort of energy, that is this total process of working down.
That is Norbert Wiener's idea,
Now, the
entire shutdown is something else, I agree.
Yes, let's stick to Needham's interpretation of entropy. You know, goes a stage further than you would. because as far as I'm concerned, it is only through the transmuting one form of energy into another
mm-hmm.
that creativity takes place.
Right.
That energy is working down in one sense
mm-hmm.
towards chaos, but it is being redeemed in terms of consciousness, and that that poetic creation is one aspect of a sort of clearinghouse whereby the energy which is decreasing in terms of entropy is being redeemed in terms of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, this is where I would totally mm-hmm. disagree with these last two statements you made.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And where I disagree with your statements about Xenarchus,
mm-hmm.
talking about determinate end tending towards certainty.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing is that here you're assuming a certain innate consciousness. When you talked about when you quoted Duncan,
this consciousness.
Was, you're assuming, in quoting Duncan, you're assuming a certain innate consciousness.
Well, I don't know how I can quote Duncan and assume. I mean, I quoted Duncan. And
well, Duncan, all right, Duncan was assuming
better, yeah,
innate consciousness.
Right.
And in quoting Duncan, you must at least have given some sort of assent.
Oh, that's a rubbish.
Right, you didn't give some sort of assent, right.
Yes,
okay.
But the very question
have to learn.
Of your quote was not to be for some particular person.
No, I quoted
you're assuming an innate consciousness.
I quoted a vast range of people with different opinions.
Yes, that's
the whole
come on, just a little of it.
Oh,
Duncan.
I mean, if you wish to be aggressive, be aggressive, but there's no point.
Who's in this argument? Is it all
like
you
said, the
finish
his
main point.
You'd say that what is random in a machine?
I didn't say it was random in a machine.
Well, I haven't even finished a statement, you don't even know it, you know. You're saying that in a machine, you can't have randomness. You can't have care.
I said what? Say it again. In any machine.
Yes, you can have randomness.
I don't know what that would mean. I'm saying that computers
yes.
can be programmed to produce randomness.
Yes, right.
That is a fact.
That's the fact I was trying to say.
Yeah.
I didn't get
mm-hmm.
it correctly. Now, you are also contrasting this with human beings.
Yeah.
Right? And what I say is that when human beings deliberately sort of face themselves with randomness. What they
How do you mean face themselves with randomness?
In the way in which Xenarchus would do it, in the way in which Rothenberg quite obviously, you know,
the
with his idea of the ecological survival kit, the way in which you're in your final, your first function of poetry is to order, not to order, but to open to experience that which can be generated from any signs and such like. Right? Now that is what I call facing oneself with randomness. Now I think in human terms you cannot do this because you are denying this clearinghouse of consciousness that would in fact, and that the equivalent of randomness in a machine in human terms is poetic failure. And this is the reason why I think the tradition of forms, the tradition which you, I suppose, in agreeing with Rothenberg would want to throw out the window, a tradition of forms. A tradition of, what you might call, traditionally established pool of consciousness is the word, a traditionally established pool of consciousness, and also of a hierarchy that in art some things are better than others. This, you know, if you're going to do without this, then all you're doing, ultimately, is making a concession
mm-hmm.
towards poetic failure,
mm-hmm.
which I find unacceptable.
Fine.
I'd like to take up a point which to me seems to me to be the key point, and this is your use or your interpretation of the word organic.
Yes, right, yes. This is crucial.
I don't frankly think that any really great work of art
mm-hmm.
can be inorganic. I also think.
Why did you say that?
No, I never said you said that.
Right.
I'm just
yeah.
making a series of statements,
yeah,
if
right.
I may.
Yeah.
I also feel that there is a certain point, whether the artist leaves it at that point or when he leaves it at a later point, at which a work of art reaches a stage of perfection, a stage where the content and the structure
mm-hmm.
are unified completely.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is the strength of the Renaissance. That you get, you get a subject which is a worthwhile subject, dealt by an individual,
mm-hmm.
as Eliot would say, that he's got a consciousness, that he's one of the elite, emotionally speaking. He has a perfect reaction, he can select the correct subject, and he treats it properly, and he cares about the subject. Now, how
mm-hmm.
can you even, I mean, it's like Sir Gulliver's Travels, isn't it? This business of computers. You know, when they go with their intellectuals. Don't you know that bit?
You mean in the Voyage of Pluto? Yes, yes.
And they go to the language laboratories because they're talking in ordinary words as a corrosion.
That diagram you mean on the page where the machine,
And you know, talking as we are doing now is a corrosion of the land.
Right.
And this is what is such a relief about Renaissance literature and painting, because it is embedded in real life, and there's a moralness and an integrity and a wholeness which all that you've said doesn't give us at all.
I want to take issue with something you did say. It isn't much to do with Cartier, I think. And like you may think it is. You spoke earlier on about some professor who'd scrambled an essay on the second law of thermodynamics.
The terminology of it?
Yeah.
He computed it, in fact, not scrambled it.
Now, it strikes me that all the way through, and the individual examples, and like many I haven't been taking notes, are so many that I can't put my finger on more than a couple, that you've been doing precisely this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very familiar sort of experience to me, because I have lots of friends who are more of the arts than they are of the sciences, and I happen to be of the sciences.
Mm-hmm.
And when they tackle scientific subjects, which they do with, you know, great abandon and energy, they produce in me the response that you produce in that poor scientist down there,
Professor Mendoza.
That you seem to be scrambling what you're handling with scientific subjects. And what this reminds me of is something that was said in a very unfashionable book, I believe it is anyway, Brave New World, where people are, in a world where employment is no longer necessary, playing Riemannian table tennis and various other things.
Yeah, right.
Elaborate games where there is no whole grasp of the sorts of relationships which exist and make up science, that is one kind of sets of relationships, but where there is a sort of vague apprehension of it, corresponding, I suppose, to the way that Coleridge looked at his clouds or something like that, you know. You don't know, for instance, what the relations between the bonding, if you like, chemical bonding between the molecules in the cloud are, but you've got a sense of cloud and a sense of force. And I'm wondering if this doesn't invalidate a great deal of what you've said, that in fact you're drawing analogies, you're talking about forces. I'll just give one specific example in case you think I'm being windy in this.
No,
you use the word organic. You know, the word organic, sort of, it's always been used, of course, to relate to living things, but it was used scientifically the first time, well, no, not the first time, but used scientifically most familiarly, when there was distinguished one kind of chemical from another kind of chemical. And then you went on to say that it was ludicrous to refer to organicity or to the organic with regard to Faulkner's South and the way he put it.
As an evaluative term.
Yeah, but you were using the word organic in two different ways.
No, I was just saying that it was impossible to use it in an evaluative term, that's all. Because it's a tautological term, it's a descriptive term, in fact.
Could I just answer you why it's impossible? If you want.
Why?
Well, if you want to, but the point is it has no backing at all from... I mean, if things are organic, it doesn't necessarily mean they're valuable.
No, but you can still... What is ever the backing for a value judgment?
Right, well, that's something else,
Can
I just, like, ask this gentleman here?
First,
I mean,
you
see that what George was saying, then, I mean, that's very important now to me.
Yes.
Because then one would have to get into another area, which I didn't discuss at all, which was, like, value judgments.
Yeah, if you are using...
You want to use organic as a value judgment.
...sort of monistic way, you know, because it applies to everything, mind and matter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then you must form your connections more precisely between the sort of laws you're talking about in science and the sorts of experience, our own experience. Experiential life, it seems to me that you can no longer, if you're going to use, if you're going to be dogmatic, you can no longer afford to be woolly around the edges when it comes to science.
I'm not sure about how this refers to organic, because what I'm objecting to is using the word organic as evaluative, that's all. You would want to use it evaluatively.
Well, Yes, but I think there are two different ways of evaluating.
The funny thing about this is, normally the word organic is used to make favourable judgments
right.
on the whole,
yes,
whereas normally
right.
the word mechanistic is used to make
right.
unfavourable judgments.
Mm-hmm.
It happens that for me, to call something organic is usually to dispraise it, and to call it mechanistic is to praise it, because it happens that I like structures which remind me more of machines than structures which remind me of trees. I think what you're getting to Faulkner is that he's trying to, as it were, he's trying to railroad people of a conventional pastoral frame of mind into believing in something because they think of it as like a tree.
That's right.
It's an unfair sort of way of handling value judgment, perhaps.
In the great modern field that I've been working at lately, has been the field of city planning and the language city planning and the language of environmental studies. And again and again and again, the prejudices towards organic forms as necessarily evaluative forms in which people live. When in fact, when you lay out the city that way, it doesn't work. Which is like a proved thing. That was the kind of problem that I was involved in.
Yes, I think it's dangerous.
It's a very important matter.
You were going to come in a long time ago.
If the poem is going to be expressed over the length of the artist's life, as in the case of somebody like Pound and the Cantos, but it comes to its final conclusion when the artist dies, is this not a kind of organic form? I mean, it corresponds to the growth of the organism, the person who is in fact creating it.
It describes it, in fact.
Well, it is a description.
I would agree.
Could I go on from this to, I found that there was a central kind of inconsistency, at least for me, in Mr. Mottram's very interesting talk. That is that you reduce all matter and experience to certain forms. The world is reduced to certain forms, patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And these are constants.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you say that it's impossible to create an art which is reducible to formal perfection. You say that formal qualities are aesthetically unacceptable, and yet you say that, in fact, the world is reducible to these things. Well, surely there is an inconsistency there.
I didn't say reducible. This word keeps coming up. I'm very puzzled by the way people
Well, underpins everything.
Not underpins. It is the structure of energy we're talking about. I was thinking, I have to refer to, you know, the sources here. A big fun.
I took a fair theatre, but you're talking about energy or emotional intelligence, and this is the trouble.
Well, that's a form, I suppose.
When you finish your point, Eric,
yes, I can't remember what it
was. Nobody's in this world. Psychokinesis, you know, be able to actually think about clouds away. Nobody's
just think it
over. That would be marvellous. I think the thing that, I think the point here is you can't possibly reduce, you see, to forms in that sort of way you're saying, because there's so many of them. I mean, the structure of morphology is such that there are so many forms, but there is in fact inside that range of forms similarities and relationships, because there's a limited number of chemical structures. This is that whole series of books edited by George K. Pierce, that's where one looks for it, and a huge analysis. I think there's about six of the damn things now. So it isn't a question of reduction, it's a question of saying how do we discover what the forms are? And there are, God knows how many. I mean, this is an exciting thing. We live in a universe of multiple variety, the most extraordinary kind. But the end, of course, as I quoted that little bit from Jung, just in case some of you recognize that from one of his books, to do with the idea of the psyche being the world, which he bases on the fact that the processes of the nervous system are in fact these proteins in the synapses and so on. Now the thing is, if you use the word reductive in that way, all I can say is, it seems to me, if you feel that there's insufficient number of forms such that you feel constrained by being identified with these forms, I would disagree. You see, I think there's so many.
Well,
I don't feel the word reductive is involved.
Criticism is possible within this non-framework of form that you're suggesting.
Yeah. Criticism of what? Criticism?
Well, I think it's relevant to talk about criticism, since we've been discussing ways in which people write.
Critical evaluation, you mean?
I mean, how is it possible to to put forward some kind of critical theory in this new context of writing.
This was the basic question I was asking with those two propositions at the end. They were propositions. They were in fact propositions to suggest that, okay, now, given this kind of material, what worries me, this is a very personal thing, to do with what do I do now about the critical terminology if I still want it. It's notorious, one of the biggest problems with the sheer amount of modern art forms, to get yourself into a position where you can make evaluative judgments between forms, which is so different. This is a real problem. I was reading, Harold Rosenberg's book on art that deals with this one. What's it called?
Prisoner
of the New. No, the next one. What's it called? I can't think. Anyway, the anxious object. It's called. The title suggests this. But there's a problem here to which Rosenberg, a very distinguished art critic, and he's like disarming himself in these essays continually from critical techniques which he can no longer use. Which is a very interesting book to watch, because he's confronted with the artist. It's the artist that makes the things and offers them and says, look what I'm doing. And then the rest of us like try and catch up by like trying to describe it if we want to. I must say increasingly I'm much more concerned with ability to respond rather than evaluating between the responses. I find by the time I've responded, there's an enormous amount to be done beyond that of evaluative stuff, which I'm finding very difficult for the simple reason that the critical terminologies that I was trained on at school and in college don't seem to be available for these works. This is a real problem to me.
Do you think the artist is building into his works themselves the critical apparatus for?
I think again and again, this is I don't think that. That is that's a standard fact that's happening in the 20th century. As I mentioned in my paper to you, that structural analysis is built into the work of art.
Yeah, well, could you adduce an example of this?
I think, well, any time a painter seems to be doing something which in fact draws attention to its own structure, I think that...
Mondrian.
Yes, I think very much so, and I think that John Cage's music and Babbitt's music and a great deal of poetry which somewhere at some point suggests to the reader this is a structure. It's one of those ways in which...
Does Bach and Mozart draw attention to the structure of their works?
I think there's
a they carry on their themes and motifs.
Yes.
Very
but my point is that there is, apart from, I think, Bach's cantatas taken as a whole, I mean, because of the range of stuff going on inside, there's a repetition of formal structures here. We're concerned with this thing, this other book that somebody mentioned just now, of Rosenberg, which is entitled The Tradition of the New. And since the early 19th century in the arts, there's been this problem. Increasingly, the artworks are non-imitative forms. They don't, in fact, are not variants on a single set of form structures. They are, in fact, endless inventions. And the problem is to find, then, a discriminating critical apparatus which copes with that. I think that... but I think it interests me very much, since you mentioned Bach, I think it interests me very much about Bach's cantatas, but I think it would be the greatest things he did is the ways in which, by juxtaposing imitative forms in a sequence, he makes, in fact, a pattern, a new pattern. But in fact, inside that, the repetition of similar forms. I think probably a great artist like Bach would do that.
Some of those computer things at the ICA where you saw mathematical progression being translated into lines.
Right, yes, yes.
And circles.
Right, yeah.
I mean, these are all in fact circumscribed by a very limited framework. They're all variations
on
a particular thing.
That was, but and they were computed.
Almost as tightly controlled as Bach.
That's because they were, the machines were quote, trained, unquote, to do it. I mean, they were in fact programmed to do just that. You set the machine structure, and of course, it comes out with that particular drive.
Can't they only be programmed in a way that is essentially circumscribed?
I think that's true, although I got some notes I didn't use. There are strange things happening now, and this is the extension of this, of linking the computer to the human nervous system in such ways that there are unpredictable things occurring. Dr. Gray Water gave a paper at a conference last year at Imperial College on the ways in which you can connect electrodes to the nervous system, human beings, and the signals coming off the electronic signals coming off the brain when the person is shown a picture can be transmitted to a computer who stores this information, such that months later, within the same electric system, when the patient, whatever it is, thinks of that picture, the computer reproduces it on a screen. And this is being used in America by connecting up fighter pilots to computer systems for combat purposes, so that they don't, in conditions of nervous strain, they can still operate with this extension, so that it's accurate. So this is a real problem to do with like the abuse of these things, but it's possible to connect the human system with the computer system to produce these unpredictable errors. But I think that's the only areas that I know where it can be done.
Alan, I think I'd like to get on to somebody else, actually, because we've had quite a lot
this
of...
This lady here has been having her
maybe
arm up for hours.
Well, no, I should give you the facts before you, because we're working a long time.
The lady with the... Please.
Mm-hmm. The feedback, George mentioned, George White mentioned, the fact that you were talking about technique rather than substance. And I got the idea, but I won't go into it because I don't think I can communicate it any better than you did, I might ask, about the relationship, let's say, between form and substance. There's just a little trivial thing that we all know, and that is that the technique itself is kind of inspirational, and this has been happening a lot in the broadening of mixed media. One example you didn't use was photography, which isn't quite as broad, but they're using various medias in the field of photography, and some people might say that it's no longer photography, but it's a combination of things, various treatments, and in some cases the treatment itself is you might say randomly, but I suspect, you know, kind of encouraging more creativeness, so that it's a kind of open circle in a sense. And I'm a bit surprised that people seem to resent this idea so much, as though we're trying to destroy the importance of the artist, when actually we're just broadening his importance. And the artist himself, with just complete enthusiasm and zest for life, if you will, is broadening the importance of art and making it include more things that are natural to it. There's still, I'm in computers, so I tend to see this more than other people, but I still see this kind of, you know, fear of computers is over the boogeyman.
That thing about photography is, you take it that, I'm right, you're thinking of the ways in which the actual photographic apparatus is used to produce accidents and things of that kind. What are you talking about? That kind of thing, yeah.
Techniques of development and
mixing I think that's starting. I don't think it's trivial at all. I think it's very important because it's implying like extensions of, as you say, the medium. In fact, in this particular case, which I agree to very much. And I think what you're saying, the other thing you're saying, is not trivial at all. It's to do with the thing I thought I did make clear, and that is that these things can be, these machines can be used, and that's what they're for. And that in fact, there's a fear of computers is just silly.
One just wonders whether the medium isn't bigger than the message.
The thing where you do get frightened is when you do hear about fighter pilots being joined onto machines for combat purposes, and then that's not whatever to do with the machines, it's to do with political policies.
No.
Well, working with their artist computer groups. Growing quite a lot, and one of the purposes of this is because some of the scientists now feel that science has gotten to this level, it's time.
Yeah.
That it really has to come closer to art and have a better understanding of it. So that they're trying to cross this gap.
Yeah, that's true. I take that.